Stay tuned for the Organic Farm Stand coming right up.
Corn in the fields, listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me.
Welcome to the Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month. My name is Richard Hill. I'm here with Steve Munno. Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Great to be here.
Steve, the executive director of Massaro Farm, and he's got a cold and rainy day out there. The worst of the rain, I think, came last night. It came in torrents in Brantford. How's it going out there today, Steve? Muddy and cold, probably?
It's cold, and it's a little wet, but I'm grateful that it's not pouring like it has been previously and hoping that it'll let up soon. You know, there seems to have been nothing but heavy rain, and though there was some spurts last night, I think, you know, it's been easy today, and that's welcome. Because we don't, you know, as we've talked about in the past few shows, the rain has been significant, you know, since last summer. So we don't need much more of it, even though we think about spring, you know, showers, bringing on the flowers. In fact, my four-year-old was saying it this morning, you know, as we walked out into the drizzling rain, spring showers will bring May flowers. But we've got plenty of moisture and the flowers are on, and, you know, I've just, despite today's sort of gloominess and coldness, really been loving the last couple of weeks of seeing the trees open and bloom. It is a glorious time here in the sort of Woodbridge, greater New Haven area. We had the Cherry Blossom Festival, you know, in New Haven and Worcester Square over the weekend, and the cherry blossoms throughout Woodbridge, the magnolia trees. It is just a beautiful time throughout the state. So even if today is a little bit, you know, dreary, it's a really lovely time right now.
Yeah. Well, this is April is a cruel month. I think they, I'm not sure if they call March the cruelest or April the cruel. April is a fickle month, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So we had some beautiful spring weather a couple of days this past week. And then, you know, the question we had in our home was, should we take the electric blanket off the bed and should we take some of the bedding off and just, you know, go with this beautiful warm weather we're getting? And I was like, nope, I don't believe it. I was born in April and I know it's not going to last. And so, yeah, a lot of ups and downs. And we definitely got a down one today because temperature coming in today, 44 degrees. And that's chilly. And
it's
definitely
chilly. Yep.
Definitely dank. Well, it's interesting, you know, when you deal with this large amount of rain coming in a small period of time, you know, I always wonder, it seems like it can turn on a dime, especially when we get some really warm and sometimes very hot weather. You know, you can get that period of very heavy rain, and then a week goes by with no rain, and everybody says, oh my God, we're in a drought. How does that play out on the farm? Like, how much do you want that rain to be kind of calibrated, you know, so it's coming every 3 days or something? You know, it just seems like drought is declared pretty quickly when the rain isn't there, almost, you know, in that sequential fashion.
Yeah, you know, in terms of growing crops, you know, in whether it's in your garden or in the farm fields, you know, the plants need water to grow. It's one of the engines of growth, along with, you know, your soil being right and your nutrients being right. The plants need water to grow, and so they need water regularly too. So when you have dry spells, you know, once that sort of moisture is gone from the surface level, now your plants need to, you know, the roots need to dig down and get water deeper in the ground. And depending on the age of your plants, you know, throughout the spring we will be transplanting, and the young plants aren't established enough to find water in deep areas. So if you have a few weeks without rain, you're suddenly, you know, approaching drought pretty quick, especially in the summer where the days are longer and you're getting, you know, more evaporation and transpiration from the plant. So, you know, those longer days, the warmer days, you're losing water faster than you are in the fall and winter. So, it can swing pretty quick. Now, it does depend, you know, the soil types you have. You know, as I've talked about here at Massaro, we have, we've got a nice sandy soil with rocks. It's not as sandy as other places throughout Connecticut where drainage and loss of water is a real issue. We hold our water pretty well, and in part because of a glacial history here, where there's, you know, we don't have several feet deep of soil going way down that it'll drain to. We've got some hard rock underneath that sort of gives us sort of a floor for our water, which in the spring can lead to puddling for us. You know, as we get these heavier rains, or even in a summer like last year, you know, the water doesn't have anywhere to go and it comes back up to the surface. But there's plenty of other places in Connecticut where, you know, their drainage is really good, and they need water, you know, more frequently than we do here. So some of that, you know, factor of drought conditions depends on your soil type. So, the state is going to map things out, you know, by sort of county and areas on the farm, the state of where conditions are a little bit different. And then plenty of farms, you know, have the capacity to irrigate, whether it's through wells or if they're using ponds to pump water, but other farms don't. So, you know, traditionally, you know, historically, you know, farmers are relying on rain. And if you don't get rainfall for a period of weeks, then, you know, some of those crops can be in trouble. But part of what we do as organic farmers and of any farmers, you know, tending their soil and thinking about that is if you're minding your soil well and you're building up the organic matter, soils with higher organic matter can actually hold more water. So they've got a better holding capacity. And when you go through these droughts, if you've got that sort of healthy, high organic matter soil, you know, they're going to be retaining water better. So they're going to be giving off that water. And then when you have the big storms, they're able to sort of absorb more water as well. So we try to build in resiliency into our farm soils by taking good care of it, by building up that organic matter, you know, reducing the amount of soil that's bare so that we're not, you know, losing soil to erosion in any of these big storms, and setting up our fields in ways you know, that we are sort of going across the slope if you've got a slopey field. So if you've been at Massaro, we've got a field that's kind of on a good slope, and even our gentle slopes, our beds are cutting across that slope. They're not going up and down the slope. Mm-hmm. They cut across the slope to slow the movement of water down the hill. So as it goes down that slope, it gets stopped by a bed, and then it, you know, dips down into another path and then up to another bed. So we don't, you know, we protect our soil this way and we capture water this way. Whereas if it were heading downhill, those paths in the bed, the water would run right down the hill off that. So yeah, there's all sorts of strategies that we employ, you know, as stewards of the soil and stewards of the land to, you know, protect our soil and help us get through these times of wet periods and dry periods.
You mentioned organic matter in the soil, and I know this is something that we've talked about a lot, but just remind me and our listeners what that means and how people can, you know, build up, as to use your term, build up the organic matter in the soil.
Yeah. So the organic matter, or soil organic matter, that's kind of the the material in the soil that's been sort of decomposed, the living and dead things, that are in the soil. There's sometimes I talk about pore space in the soil too. That's sort of a different thing. We need space in the soil for roots to travel, for water to travel, for worms to travel, for all the fungal life, bacterial life, invertebrates to move. But the soil organic matter, that's all the sort of things that are living there in various states of, life and death decomposition. So one of the things we've talked about is our cover crop that we use here. So a variety of different things that we grow to feed the soil and protect the soil. Well, that's kind of, those peas, those oats, that vetch that grows up, the buckwheat or the rye and clover, as that grows, that's organic matter that's not been decomposed into the soil yet. But when we mow it down and incorporate into the soil, that's breaking down and sort of building that soil organic matter. Whereas if we are just growing a cash crop, we're just growing that lettuce or those tomatoes, and then we're removing, that organic matter from the field and not putting anything back, we're losing organic matter that way. We're sort of growing things up and extracting and not putting it back in there. So, it's the material in the soil there.
So what's the technique when you talk about your cover crops? Do you literally turn them and let them just dissolve into the soil, decompose into the soil, or what do folks do with their little gardens that they may have in their backyard?
Yeah, there's a few ways. So if you're, in the garden, a lot of folks might have put, leaves or lawn clippings over the garden, to protect it for the winter. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have, maybe slowly broken down over the winter months, or now you come out in the spring and you're ready to work that soil a little bit. Maybe you're raking it in a little bit. Those leaves will break down, and that's part of building organic matter. You're both protecting it with the covering, but then you're sort of incorporating that into the soil and building that organic matter there. And all those worms, the beetles and things, they're going to feed on that too. And they're going to help build the organic matter that way. They're using that organic matter to feed and sort of help the whole soil ecology as well. So on the garden, it's what you're adding in there and protecting. If you're growing cover crop in the garden, some of it might still be alive. Some of it might have winter killed and it sort of turned to a brown that protected the soil. Well, now you can sort of chop that up into the soil, or you could remove it and put it in your compost pile, and then you're putting maybe compost back into your bed along with any other fertilizer needs. And that's adding the organic matter as well. So sometimes on a garden level, it can be hard to incorporate cover crop. If it's still alive, you can mow it and leave it in place, or you can pull it out and compost it and then bring compost back in. And so similarly for us in the field, there's stuff that we will mow and then we're dropping it right in place. We're not bagging up our mowings. We're leaving it right there. And then we might lightly incorporate. So I was actually doing this just yesterday before the rain. We had some cover crop that had winter killed, and actually we had some oats this year that didn't winter kill. So a mowed, and then used a light disc, which is just, sort of a group of discs and kind of like dinner plates with a slightly sharp edge, and just gently chopping that into the soil to help break that down. So just like if you're managing a compost pile, it'll break down better and faster if you chop it up a little bit. Like if you throw a whole banana peel, you don't break it up, or an orange peel or something, or a whole loaf of bread, it doesn't break down as quickly as if you break it up a little bit. So in the field, we're mowing that cover crop and giving it that gentle chop. We're not trying to do a big soil disturbance with the tills, and just trying to get that soil contact. Mow it, lay it on the mower lays it on the ground, then come back with a disc or a tool to gently break it up a little bit more, get that soil contact so the soil organisms are there to help start breaking it down and incorporating it into the soil.
And so how much time do you need when, let's say, at this stage of the game, can we be doing that now? Can we be sort of trying to weed out maybe some of the tougher grasses that have grown up? And sometimes those things are like they're very deeply rooted and hard to pull out. I wonder, like in my little garden, you know, should I try, are those going to be sucking the lifeblood out of the soil? Should I get rid of them or should I try to chop them up and let them stay there? I wonder if they're going to, you know, regenerate, you know, if I leave them there. And but the other, I guess I started the question by asking, is this the time to actually be trying to leave organic matter, leaves, grass clippings, and other things that are still growing in the garden that, you know, like have cropped up, you know, or survived through the winter? Is this the time to do that, or is it too late to be doing it?
I would say it's not too late to do anything, and you know, the less helpful answer it all is, it depends. It all depends on what you're hoping to do with your garden, what you want to plant, when you want to plant. You know, we haven't planted a single thing outside on the farm yet. Everything that we've planted has been inside of our tunnels. Mm-hmm. I know there are folks planting in their farms outside, and there are folks planting in their gardens outside. So it's doable. You know, there are some things you don't want to plant just yet. You know, we're not ready for, you know, cucumbers and squash and tomatoes to be outside because we still have nights, you know, in the low 40s, and even we were at 37 degrees today. So, you know, those plants can't handle that. Even something like basil, you know, shouldn't be outside right now. So we're just starting with those plants. Those are still in the greenhouse. But, you know, another 3 to 4 weeks, they'll be ready to go outside. I usually think about May 10th, depending where you are in the state, that might vary a little bit. But, you know, there are hardier things that are about ready. You know, people probably have peas outside they might have planted a month ago. You know, things that are a little hardier, radishes, some lettuce, some kale, some collards, some broccoli, some turnips. There are things that could be outside now. So it depends what you're hoping to plant, what you want in your garden, to the timing. But because there are things, you know, it's spring and the grass is kind of ready to grow, and you might see some vigorous grass growth. It's a good time if you want to remove particular things, you know, remove them sooner than later so they don't get established, and they don't become harder to remove, you know, in a month. So if you've got some time in your garden, this is a good time to think about removing things that you don't want there, so that they don't become harder to remove, you know, in another 3 to 4 weeks.
Uh-huh. And, right, okay, so, yeah, so I'm going to mow down. See, I do have some overwintered herbs that survived, like some thyme, and I believe it is sage that survived the winter. Maybe some oregano too in my garden. It's mostly an herb garden that I have because the critters eat everything else. They don't like the herbs, thank God. But maybe I can let them see if they'll regenerate a bit. But the other things, I'm just, according to what you're saying, I'm going to chop them down and try to turn them a bit and try to get them into the soil. And I'm not going to be doing any planting probably until for almost another month. So hopefully, according to what you're saying, I can let that stuff sort of decompose and become part of the organic matter in the soil.
Yes. And to be clear, I was really referring to cover crops, you know, so, you know, things like oats and peas and buckwheat, stuff that overwintered. You know, if you had a cover crop, it might be rye. And rye is a pretty vigorous grower in the spring, so it might just be starting to go. And it's a tough one to terminate. I usually don't recommend people put rye in their gardens for that reason. It's a nice thing that will get a little bit established in the fall, and then will grow vigorously in the spring, but it's tough to kill off. And usually the sort of mowing and turning can do it. You can pull it out in clumps too, I suppose, but, a tarp can work as well. You can, you know, sort of keep it free from light and you know, weigh that tarp down, and that can help kill off something that's growing if you don't want it to grow. So that's a good strategy. But if you've got a cover crop or any other just organic matter, yes, you can totally chop it up and incorporate it. But if you think it's something you really don't want to come back, if it's a grass, you know, grasses, because they grow from below the soil, you know, you can break up their rhizomes and just spread them. So you got to be careful with what it is that you're trying to take down. So, you know, it's really referring to the cover crop is what we chop up and put in place, or if you put some lawn grass clippings or some leaves on top of your garden to protect it, and you want to stir that in and chop that up, that can definitely be beneficial and help build that organic matter and provide some fertility for your soil.
All right. That's good good advice. All right. And we're speaking with Steve Munno, who is a director of Massaro Farm, which is in Woodbridge, on Ford Road in Woodbridge. Steve, I looked for you at the New Haven Farmers Market this past Saturday, and I couldn't find you. Are you alternating between the New Haven Worcester Square Market and the Edgewood Park Market? Edgewood Park. Yeah, that would be.
I'm sorry we missed you there. We, you know, were attending the winter market over the winter months, and we made it to that first opening market at Worcester Square at the Conte West School. And now we're taking a few weeks off. We will be at the opening market at Edgewood Park Sunday. It's the first Sunday in May, which the date escapes me at the moment. But so we will be there. And we actually have a few Earth Day events coming up. We've obviously got Earth Day, which I believe is Monday, coming up. But there's events throughout the next week, all weekend, probably throughout the state. There's going to be a number of Earth Day events. And we will be at the Ansonia Nature Center just around the corner from us in Ansonia this Saturday. And there's a big Earth Day festival there. And there's a number of farms and local food providers and other local groups that'll have a little market area as part of that. And then the next Saturday, the 27th, Woodbridge has its own Earth Day event, and we'll have a stand there as well. So unfortunately, we're not at Worcester Square the next few weeks as we're taking part in these Earth Day events.
Aha. Uh-huh. And speaking of Earth Day events, WPKN will have a major and full day Earth Day programming and fundraising day starting, I think, quite early in the morning and running through most of the daylight hours. And I'm going to be participating in that along with Kevin Gallagher. Melinda Tuhus will be here as well. I think I'm going to try to get our friend Esther Armand to come down. She is the woman who grew up on the Mississippi Delta on a big family farm down there. She'll come and say a few words, but we'll have all kinds of little snippets from people who are talking about their impressions and feelings about Earth Day. Join us for that, because there'll be all kinds of festivities coming here, music, chat, your potentially and hopefully your contributions to this station, which does depend on you so very much to be a thriving community station. So, I want to mention that we have a special guest today, Doug Talamay, who is an entomologist, an ecologist, and conservationist, and he is going to be talking to us about how to sustain the natural ecologies that are being threatened by so many factors in our modern world here. We're going to be talking about the role of things like keystone plants, which is a term that Doug has coined, and the importance of something we take for granted, something as ever-present as oak trees, and why those are so important to the ecology and the sustainability of our environment. All kinds of issues like that we're going to be talking about: invasive plants, native plants versus ornamentals that people have in their yards. That coming up in just 5 minutes. Doug Talamay will be with us. And I want to thank Laura Modlin for helping to get Doug on track today. And so that will be coming up in a minute. Steve, I did want to ask you a big question, one that we started to talk about when you came down to the farmers market and WPKN was broadcasting from the market two Saturdays ago. And that was this issue of, can this movement of small farms, some of them organic, most of them following organic practices, can this movement actually counterbalance big agriculture and the tendency of giant agribusinesses to blanket the planet with their practices and some of their really draconian commercial demands, such as using their what used to be Monsanto is now Bayer, their seed types, and all kinds of things that big agriculture is purveying. There are people who argue that the small farmers can actually feed the planet. And I'm wondering what your opinion is of this issue of, can we actually win this battle with the farms such as Massaro and others in our neighborhood, but also around the planet that are being threatened, I think, by big agriculture? Who's going to win this battle, and what your thoughts are on that? And
gotcha. Yeah, it's a big question. And I try to, you know, when thinking about things like this, take a step back to look at big picture and some and history. And I'm sort of comforted by the history of the world feeding itself with small farms throughout our existence. So, you know, it's a newer trend to have these larger farms, and it's a newer trend to be, you know, moving people off of land and, you know, using smaller numbers of people to work bigger pieces of land and using more machines to work larger plots of land. But even as that change is happening now, I think if we take a big picture at the globe, really the world is still largely, you know, run by smallholder farms throughout the world. So not just the U.S., but there's when you look at a census for Connecticut or for the U.S., there's many, many thousands of small farms. And they're playing a big role in feeding their communities. And when you look internationally and globally, you've got smallholder farmers really doing the work of feeding their communities. We do need to put in, you know, intention and effort to keep that going for centuries to come. I think, you know, there's maybe some value to some of the larger farms and the type of things that they can produce and the way they can produce it. But I think there is extraordinary value to the small farms and how they contribute to the communities, how they provide, you know, resilience through, you know, times like we had with the pandemic and being able to provide food locally. You think of any kind of crisis or conflict, you know, having food produced locally and preserved locally is really important to our, I think, survival and our sort of community relationships. You know, we started talking about it at Worcester Square at the opening market there, in part because of the great work that City Seed has done. And I think, you know, it's not just the farmers doing the farm work, but it's also the community support and the community organizations that help create a culture to support small and local businesses. And City Seed is entering its 20th year, and we're celebrating that. And I think, you know, without an organization like City Seed, you know, there might not be an avenue for viability for a lot of the small farms and food businesses. So, you know, it's not just vegetables being sold there. You got vegetables and flowers and meats and cheese and milk. And then, you know, people, bakeries, added value goods, you know. So there's a lot happening at those markets, and we need kind of all of the community to be behind these local farms and local businesses to make this work. Of course, there's a role for supermarkets to play. Of course, there's going to be a role for some larger operations. But I think, you know, we've gotten to where we are thousands of years of our existence to, you know, by providing ourselves for ourselves, working together as communities to do it. And I think we can do that going forward. We need to continue to have the intention to make that happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for that. And we will keep coming back to this topic, because I think there are so many nuances to this and big issues that we have to really address when we're talking about not just supporting small farms, but really making them be a contender in this battle for how the planet is going to be fed. And so we'll absolutely be discussing this going forward. Well, right now, I do want to introduce our special guest, Doug Talamay. He's an entomologist, an ecologist, and conservationist. He's a professor at the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. He's written countless articles and several inspirational books about ecology and the restoration of natural systems. Doug Talamay advocates for home gardens and landscaping that bridge the gap between parks and preserves and providing habitat for natural species. And you've spoken on the connection between plants and insects and how those relations are important to supporting numerous species of birds. He's called for smaller lawns and more oak trees. And we're going to hear more about that in a moment. I just want to mention some of Doug's books. The Nature of Oaks is one of them. And the subtitle there is The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Those being oak trees, as I mentioned before. What we might regard as commonplace. He regards them as key to a very healthy, sustainable ecology. Another one, Nature's Best Hope. How You Can Save the World is the name of that book. And a third one, Bringing Nature Home. And I think he means to our individual homes there. Doug Talamay, thank you so much for being with us today on the Organic Farm Stand.
Yeah, happy to be here, Richard.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So why don't we kick it off by talking a little bit about your overall approach to what constitutes a healthy environment and how these interactive systems have to really be balanced and supported as we generate, in some cases, very bland landscaping around our individual homes.
Right. Well, let's start with your first question. What constitutes a healthy environment? We depend on the life support that ecosystems provide. We call them ecosystem services. But to have a healthy ecosystem, you have to have all of its parts. And that means lots of plant species, lots of animal species all interacting together. So when we simplify our landscapes, when we make giant lawns, when we essentially remove most of the trees, you're destroying the production of those ecosystem services. So a healthy environment means one where you've got those ecosystems churning along, providing the life support that we all need. And of course, we now have 8 billion people on the planet. And every time we add another person, we need more ecosystem services instead of fewer. So we're going against each other because we keep degrading our ecosystems by developing. I love that word, developing. We're destroying the natural systems that support us. So my solution to this is we do have parks and we do have preserves, but obviously they're not big enough. We're now in the sixth great extinction event the planet has ever experienced. So I think we've got to start practicing conservation outside of parks and preserves. That's on our private property. And that's why I keep talking about, bringing nature home, bring it to where we live, to recreate the ecosystem function that used to be in our human-dominated landscapes, but has now largely been destroyed.
Right. And we're going to get to the issue of like what people are planting around their houses, sustaining large swaths of just grass, ornamental grass, I guess you could call it, that doesn't have any pollination potential. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a moment. But I noticed in some of your talks, which I listened to online and which are available, if you folks go to YouTube, they can just type in the word Doug Talamay, and Talamay is T-A-L-L-A-M-Y. And you can hear really fascinating discussions by Doug online. But use the word food web as opposed to food chain. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Right. Well, when we picture a chain, we picture maybe a plant, and then one thing eats that, and one thing eats that, and it's very linear. But that's not really the way it is. You might have a plant. Let's say we've got an oak tree. Well, in the mid-Atlantic states, oaks support 557 species of caterpillars. So imagine 557 lines going out from that oak tree, and then there are thousands of things that eat those caterpillars. So all those lines are connected, and it very quickly becomes a web, looks like a spider web, as opposed to a linear chain. So the term food web is just a lot more accurate about what's going on out there.
All right. And another word that you use, which I think is important, is keystone.
Right.
What I'm looking
keystone
for.
Species.
Keystone
yeah.
Species. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are those and what role do they play in a sustainable ecology?
Well, that's just a term that ecologists use to designate particular species that have an outsized impact on their environment. So I call, for example, we were talking about oaks. I call oaks keystone species because they do support so many caterpillars, and caterpillars happen to be the meat and potatoes of terrestrial food webs. if you don't have caterpillars, you don't have birds and lots of other things. So the plants that make the most caterpillars turn out to be very valuable in terms of supporting those food webs. And it turns out that oaks and a few other plants are producing most of the caterpillars that are out there, far more than the other plant species. So they're really, really important. And if you don't have them in your landscape, you pretty much have food web collapse. So that's the concept. Keystone. Keystone refers to the stone in the middle of the Roman arch. If you take that stone out of the arch collapses. Well, if you dig keystone plants out of your local food web, the food web collapses.
What are a couple of other keystone plants?
Willows are right there below oaks. Native cherries, so native prunus, black cherry and pin cherry are very high. Hickories are very high. Maples are high. Pines are high. 14% of our native plants we consider to be keystone plants.
And why don't we also talk now about the issue of non-native plants and how they may not just be non-interactive in terms of producing a balanced ecology, but maybe even detrimental to those systems.
You know, we've had this idea that plants are just decorations. So we go all over the world looking for the prettiest plants, and they're really pretty plants. And that's what we've been selling in our nurseries for, many decades now. So if you go to the average suburban lot and you look at where the plants are from, about over 80% of them are not from this continent. They're typically from Asia, depending on where you live. If you're in Florida, then they're from South America and some other places. But the problem with that is it gets back to that food web, and it gets back to the importance of caterpillars. So let's just use birds rearing their young as an example, and I'm going to use the chickadee because we've got a lot of data on chickadees. It takes 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to make one nest of chickadees, and that depends on the number of chicks in the nest. Well, if I plant a crepe myrtle, if I plant a ginkgo, or any of a number of these other ornamental plants, they don't produce any caterpillars. So where's the chickadee going to get all those caterpillars if it's trying to breed in my yard? It's not going to fly 5 miles down the road to the nearest woodlot. They only forage about 50 meters from the nest. So when we landscape with plants from other continents that do not support the caterpillars that we need, then the chickadee can't breed, and the titmouse can't breed, and the cardinal can't breed. And it's one of the reasons that we hear the statistics that we're hearing all the time, like North America's lost 3 billion breeding birds in the last 50 years. That's a third of our North American bird population already gone. Now, there's several reasons for that, but not having enough food to rear your young is one of those reasons. So that's why our plant choices in our human-dominated landscapes become really important.
What are some other ornamentals that people naturally go to? For example, I think a lot of people have forsythia growing in their lawn areas, rhododendrons and things like that. Can you mention their role, and are any of those, producing a positive effect in our landscape?
Well, they're pretty. that was their main goal. You mentioned forsythia and rhododendrons. Most of the rhododendrons we plant are from Asia. Now, they're not invasive, meaning they're not escaping our yards. They're not running amok in our natural areas. So that's good, but I like to think of them as if they're statues. They're pretty and they're there, but they're not contributing anything. But we have a number of ornamental plants that are they're detrimental. They have become invasive. So things like calorie pear, which escapes our planting and runs amok in our natural areas. You can see it in the spring. All those white trees that are blooming everywhere, those are calorie pears or Bradford pears that are spreading on their own. They were not planted. Burning bush is another one. Barberry is another one. These things have taken over huge areas. Actually, literally millions of acres are covered with privet. So these are huge problems, and they all have come. They're escapees from our gardens. And what they're doing is pushing out those keystone plants in our natural areas and replacing them with plants that produce almost nothing in terms of the food web. And that is what the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let me mention one that is plaguing our neighborhoods down here in southern Connecticut right now, and that is lesser celandine.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it's just, talk about an invasive. I mean, that plant is just unstoppable, apparently. But is there a way to stop some of these plants that are really low to the ground? They're really blanketing our areas.
Yeah, they're very, very hard. You can spray them. I mean, you can kill them that way, but you also kill everything else when you do that. And we don't want to spray the whole world. I've got Japanese stiltgrass on our property. It's an annual. It's everywhere. It's just a huge problem. And other than spraying it, it is a real challenge to control these things. The woody plants like autumn olive and bush honeysuckle and burning bush, things like that, they're actually very easy to control compared to lesser celandine or you know, stiltgrass or phragmites or Japanese knotweed. These things are just really, really tough to control. So, you know, people tend to throw up their hands, but that means it's almost like paving over your landscape in terms of the food web value. So it's a real problem.
No solutions have emerged so far for some of these things. Like let's take lesser celandine, because that's one. Yeah. I think in our neck of the woods, people are dealing with that right now. My next door neighbor, his entire lawn is covered with it. We have large patches of it that spring up each year, and they seem to get bigger each year.
Do get bigger each year. Yeah, I have heard no solution. I you know, if it's in his lawn, he's lucky because he could mow it. That'll help. But when they get in wetlands and areas, it just don't know what to do.
One thing about them, just in case people don't know what they are, they're really quite beautiful when they bloom. It's just like this bright, brilliant yellow flower, and they're great profusion of them tend to happen, you know, when they're blooming in your area. And they have a kind of, I guess, a rather shiny yellow, a green leaf, which surrounds the flower. They're low to the ground. You could mow them, although they almost might escape the mower because they're pretty low to the ground. And the other thing about them is they disappear pretty quickly. When the flowers, it lasts about maybe two and a half, 3 weeks, and then the flowers die, and then the leaves tend to wither so that they don't stick around in terms of their visual impact too long. But the next year, you're going to have more of them, absolutely. And I think they spread through rhizomes.
Vegetatively, yeah. You know, the one good thing, if there is a good thing, is that other plants can grow up through. They've got these little bulbs, and they can grow up right through the bulbs. So that if you look at an area that had lesser celandine in the spring, in August, there will be other plants there. So they're not blanketing the area, you know, 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they're just one. We've got 3,300 species of plants from other continents that are doing similar things in North America. So when you add all that up, it is a tremendous hit on our ecosystems.
Actually, I just want to mention this. I did a little research on this, and I discovered that actually lesser celandine, the entire plant is edible.
Oh,
especially,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, especially the tubers, the root systems of them. They need to be cooked, however. I imagine you could clean and steam them, and then they're edible and quite, you know, delicious, actually, apparently.
Oh, I'll remember that.
Yeah, that might be a way to get, if we can get people all harvesting their lesser celandine, maybe we can get rid of something. Yeah, so what else can you tell us about the oak tree? Very, very ubiquitous tree, but how is this a keystone plant, and what are some wonderful stories you can tell us about oak trees?
Well, I look at the ecological goals of every landscape that's out there. There's four things every landscape should be doing. They should be supporting the food web. So the plants that are on that landscape should be capturing energy from the sun, turning it into food, and then passing it on to local animals. They should be supporting pollinators. 80% of our plants are pollinated by animals, and 90% of our flowering plants. So it's not just about agriculture. Every landscape has to manage the watershed in which it lies. And every single landscape is in a watershed. And then finally, to fight climate change, we have to build landscapes that store carbon, that sequester carbon, pull it out of the atmosphere and tie it up in plant tissues and then pump it into the ground. And out of those four ecological goals, oaks are the very best tree in terms of three of those goals, and they do contribute to the fourth one. So let's start with the fourth one. It's pollination. Oaks are wind pollinated, so you don't need pollinators to move the pollen around. But bees do go to the catkins when they're in bloom, which is very soon, like the next 2-3 weeks, and they gather up the pollen and they do use it. So oaks are supporting pollinators. Oaks are sequestering more carbon than any other tree because they're dense wood and they're large. Oaks manage the watershed better than other plants because they have big root systems. And they also make leaf litter that lasts a long time. So it's a buffer against heavy rains and food webs. Of course, oaks are passing on more energy to the food web than any other plant genus in the country. So they're just wonderful plants in terms of all the ecological things that our landscapes should be doing.
Yeah, talk about a little bit about the acorn and how that plays into our species interaction.
Okay. Of course, oaks do make acorns, and it's a handy little package of food, very high in protein. A lot of animals depend on it. And a healthy oak tree can make over 1 million acorns in its lifetime. So it's producing a lot of food. Doesn't do it every year. But when it does, there's so many creatures that depend on it. Lots and lots of birds depend on acorns. Big birds, too. Turkeys, sandhill cranes, black bears love the acorns. Of course, our deer love the acorns. Wood ducks love acorns. There's an interesting story relationship between blue jays and acorns. I should say all jay species. They are the primary disperser of oak acorns. They'll take an acorn, they'll fly up to a mile from the parent tree, and then they tap that acorn beneath the soil surface. And the object is they're going to go back in the wintertime and have something to eat. But for every four acorns they bury, they only remember where one is. So for every four acorns they bury, they've actually planted three oak trees. And a single jay can bury 4,500 acorns every fall. So it's jays that are moving oak trees around more efficiently than any other deciduous tree.
What do we do when we get these little sprouts that come? I mean, I think, maybe two oak trees on my very small property. And there are a lot of, you know, seedlings that crop up from these. Should we nurture them? Or in a sense, you know, some native plants can start to move around a little bit more than you want them to.
Right. You look at the size of your property. This brings up the conversation of lawn. We've got 44 million acres of lawn in this country. And a good way to reduce that lawn is to increase the number of trees on your property. So if you have acorn sprouts coming up, seedlings, now is the time. As soon as they come up in the spring, that is the time to move a tree if you want to start a new tree and fill in some of that lawn with new plantings. This is the time to do it. When we moved into our yard, it had been mowed for hay, so there was nothing here. And I planted a lot of oaks the very first year, and I did it as acorns. Today, those trees are over 60 feet tall, so they do grow. The only challenge right now is protecting the little oaks from deer, because we got way too many deer, and they'll come on your property and they'll eat them. So I have little cages around them. But you know, that's free. You're getting one of the most ecologically powerful plants on the planet for free in your yard. So if it's germinating, that's good. Maybe you can pot them up and sell them.
Sure. Take them to the farmer's market. That's a great idea.
Right. That's right.
Well, we're speaking with Doug Talamy, who's an entomologist and ecologist and conservationist. He is a professor at the University of Delaware. It's been fantastic to have you here. We're really down to our last couple of minutes. I'm wondering if there are any last words you want to say. You know, what might make a balanced lawn for, you know, folks who do have some lawn space in terms of a balance between ornamental plants that are non-native and native species? Like, what do you think is a good balance?
Well, you know, when I say we should reduce the area of lawn, not get rid of lawn. So lawn is the perfect plant to walk on. So wherever you're going to walk, that's where you should keep lawn. You can keep it, we call it a cue for care, a mowed strip next to a new bed you put in or next to your driveway or your sidewalk. And that shows that whatever you're doing there is intentional and you understand what the culture is. We did a study looking at what type of biomass of native plants do you need to sustain a healthy food web in your yard? And it was only one study, but the answer was 70%. If you have 70% of your woody plant biomass is native, then you can have chickadees and other things breeding there successfully. But that means 30% of your plants can be those ornamentals, as long as they're not invasive. We can't have any calorie pears or burning bush.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can have your crepe myrtle or your ginkgo or your hostas, the things that are not moving around, as long as 70% of the important plants in your yard are native. And you want some of those to be those keystone species.
Wonderful. Well, Doug, we really have to let it go here. We'd love to have you come back and talk more. And we thank you so much for leading up to our celebration of Earth Day. Thank you so much, Doug Talamay, for joining us today. And this is the Organic
for the Opportunity.
Our pleasure. This is the Organic Farm Stand. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thank you.